From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
People say, do I regret about taking LSD? My answer is two things I regret. I should have taken more psychedelic drugs and I should have made love more.
That's Timothy Leary, the one-time Harvard professor who became the apostle of LSD. Leary's mantra, turn on, tune in, drop out, may have captured the zeitgeist of the 60s, but it was bad news for later scientists who wanted to study the effects of hallucinogens. Only now, decades later, are a few maverick scientists once again studying hallucinogens in the lab.
I think we needed to wait several decades for the rancor of the 60s to be put to rest, and we needed the protagonists to exit the stage. And, to paraphrase the Moody Blues, Timothy Leary really is dead.
Today we'll meet a new generation of scientists out to revolutionize our understanding of hallucinogens. And Dennis McKenna takes us inside Brazilian shamanism and his own mind-blowing experience with ayahuasca.
I was in a deep visionary state, and I'm a botanist and a plant biochemist, and so I found myself experiencing photosynthesis from the inside, deep in the earth, and essentially in the root of an enormous ayahuasca plant.
Rowan Griffiths is one of a handful of scientists at the forefront of new research on psychedelics. A neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins University, he's been studying the effects of mind-altering drugs for decades. Now he's turned his attention to one of the classic hallucinogens, psilocybin, commonly known as magic mushrooms. What he found is startling. Most of his research subjects reported life-changing mystical experiences. Steve Paulson caught up with Griffiths at a recent conference on psychedelics. They talked about his findings and some of the early research on hallucinogens.
Psilocybin really first became available for experimental work back in the late 1950s, and there was a lot of research conducted very early on. And then we had the 1960s and Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary with his famous LSD experiments.
And his famous slogan, turn on, tune in, drop out. And he really, in combination with the excessive use of psilocybin and LSD, it really ended up leading to a drug abuse epidemic. And Leary's active promotion of the non-medical use of these compounds gave a scientific approach to studying these compounds a very bad name.
So the government stepped in and said, forget it. There can be no study of any of these kinds of substances.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It was really a consensus decision. So no single person in government said, you can't do this. Getting approval for research of this type got incrementally more difficult. The Drug Enforcement Administration made it more difficult. The funding sources for doing this kind of research dried up. And then even within the academic community, there was some sense that these compounds were just too dangerous to study. And so it wasn't as though they were really banished, but they were functionally banished by all these hurdles that were put up.
Did you have a hard time convincing your university to approve the study?
Well, I can put it this way, that I've been doing clinical pharmacology research for over 30 years, and approval of this trial was an order of magnitude more difficult than any other trial I've gotten approval for. And that difficulty came both at the level of the Food and Drug Administration and our own institutional approval. But by my way of thinking, my institution was doing the right thing. There was this cultural bias against doing research like this, so they really needed to be convinced that the risk-benefit ratio was favorable to allow this kind of research to go forward.
So here you were. You finally got the go-ahead to do your study. How did you set it up? Who were your research subjects, and how did you design the study?
Well, our first study was really done as a straight-out comparative pharmacology study. We thought just a very careful characterization of the effects of a high dose of psilocybin relative to some active control compound would be of value. I personally was interested in spiritual aspects of drug effects.
But, and that's really what you were studying, right? I mean, what kinds of, I suppose you could say, what kinds of mystical experiences might have been induced by taking psilocybin?
No, we were studying more broadly the effects of psilocybin relative to methylphenidate. Now, we had a number
of... That is Ritalin.
That's Ritalin.
All your research subjects were taking both psilocybin and Ritalin, and you were comparing the results?
Yeah, the design of the trial was one in which volunteers participated for two or three sessions, and they all received a high dose of psilocybin and a high dose of methylphenidate. However, the volunteers and the people monitoring the study with them in their room didn't know that it was only a comparison of psilocybin versus methylphenidate. So we were really controlling for expectancy. People thought that they could receive a high dose of psilocybin or low or medium doses of psilocybin. They thought they could possibly receive methylphenidate, but 11 other compounds as well, dextromethorphan and caffeine and nicotine.
So they really had no idea what they were given.
And then another important feature is that the volunteers had no experience with classical hallucinogens, so they couldn't definitively recognize the effects of psilocybin if they got it.
How many people participated in your study?
In our first study, 36 volunteers participated. Their mean age was 46 years. They were highly educated. It was really a high-functioning professional group. We had physicians and ministers and nurses and pastoral counselors and business owners, consultants. They were people who were curious. Most of them had some kind of interest in spirituality. We did that because of the long cultural historical use of psilocybin in religious contexts.
So what did you find when these 36 people took their psilocybin?
All the other questions that we were prepared to answer about the difference between methylphenidate and psilocybin dropped away as trivial, when what emerged was this effect on questionnaires that are designed to measure primary mystical experience.
So this is the kind of thing where people talk about the unity of everything and sort of the breaking down of boundaries between yourself and the rest of the world, that kind of oceanic feeling?
Yeah, there's several defining characteristics, but first and foremost is exactly that, the sense of unity, the sense of the interconnectedness of all things. And then closely coupled with that is a sense of deep reverence or sacredness. There's something very special about this experience, something that's awe-inspiring, being in the presence of the majesty of whatever it is. And then this is coupled with this quality of a noetic sense. There's some informational value about this experience that makes it seem more real than everyday waking consciousness. People can absolutely know at a very deep and profound level that they're familiar with this experience and that it's very real. And then the other qualities of the experience are often that there's a sense of heart opening. Some people describe it as infinite love or peace. There's a transcendence of time and space, where past and present drop out and people come into the very present moment. And then there's a sense of ineffability that people can't put this experience into words. In our study, our first study, 61% of the volunteers fulfilled all those criteria.
61%? I mean, you're talking about really a profound reaction.
Yes, and our subsequent study has shown 75% of people fulfill these criteria for having a mystical experience. What really makes it interesting, though, is not just the description of the effect itself, but the fact that 2 months after the session and 14 months after the session, people came back and filled out questionnaires, and we interviewed them. And the attributions made to this experience are undiminished. People are reporting that this experience is among the most personally meaningful and spiritually significant experience of their lifetimes.
In terms of the actual numbers there, wasn't it something like 70% said that this was among the top five most meaningful experiences in their life?
Yes, yep, that's exactly right. And so people would compare this to a birth of a firstborn child or the death of a parent. These are profound and deeply memorable events. And people are comparing this 6-7 hour session in our laboratory to that kind of event in their life.
Didn't you also have some not-so-positive results, people who reported great fear and anxiety?
Indeed, we did, and I think that's very important to emphasize here, that in spite of the careful selection we did and the hours of preparation we did with our volunteers prior to the session and the very safe environment that we created, which involved laying on a couch with eye shades and headphones in the presence of two people, in spite of all that, 30 to 40% of people had experiences of great fear sometime during the session. In most cases, that fear then transformed into something else, and in a lot of cases, people valued that experience. But in its extreme form, this sense of anxiety and fearfulness is really quite striking. It just underscores the risk that people undergo if they use these compounds outside of a setting in which they're closely monitored and supervised.
Now, you said that all the people in your study, and at least in your first study, had spiritual interests, were either actively part of a church or just were inclined toward spiritual interest. Do you think results would be different if atheists participated? I mean, would they be less susceptible to such mind-altering experiences?
Well, that's a great question and one that we would love to have the funds to address. My thought is that someone who was absolutely committed, a committed non-believer, that it strikes me as very improbable that an experience of this sort is going to have them find God, if you will. It's possible, but it seems unlikely. But yet, an experience of this sort may be languaged in a different way, one in which people say, this was the most meaningful experience of my life. I don't believe that stuff about God, but I understand the interconnectedness of all things. I'm not going to use the term sacred to describe it, but I'm humbled by it. And you know, and then you're coming pretty close to what some people would call spirituality.
That's Roland Griffiths, a behavioral biologist at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He talked with Steve Paulson at a conference on psychedelics and consciousness at the Biopharmaceutical Technology Center in Madison, Wisconsin. The British writer Aldous Huxley was one of the pioneers in exploring the effects of hallucinogens. His book, The Doors of Perception, recounted his own experiences with mescaline. Here's an excerpt from the BBC's 1958 interview with Huxley.
In your book about mescaline recently, you talked of a state of heightened perception being induced, a valuable state of heightened perception, being induced by drugs, by proper drugs. Do you think imaginative writers would benefit by that?
Well, I think the people who would benefit most of all are professors. And I think it would be extremely good for almost anybody with fixed ideas and with a great certainty about what's what to take this thing and to realize that the world he has constructed is by no means the only world, that there are these extraordinary other types of universe which we may inhabit and which we should be very grateful for inhabiting, I think.
That recording is from the British Library's Spoken Word collection. So, is drug-induced mysticism really comparable to a classic mystical experience without the drugs? It's a question Stephanie Simon explores in her book, The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. It's a cultural history that cuts across an enormous swath of spiritual movements and recounts the stories of Aldous Huxley, Timothy Leary, and the Indian swamis who landed on American soil. Simon says today's scientific study of psychedelics could lead to new breakthroughs.
I think it's new in that they have learned the lessons of the 60s, and by that I mean the early 60s, when Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were studying psychedelics at Harvard, supposedly scientifically, and they were doing very active research into the spiritual potential of psychedelics. But as many people remember, they were so passionate about their work and such engaged participants in psychedelics, and they were dropping acid and taking mushrooms, and their enthusiasm ended up stirring up more controversy than positive press, unfortunately, and led to them getting essentially fired from their positions at Harvard as social scientists. But it was really Aldous Huxley who brought the attention to the spiritual potential of psychedelics, and that really began actually in the early 50s.
Well, let's talk about that a little, because the historical perspective does matter. We tend to think of the 60s as the age of psychedelics, but it was, what, 1954 when Huxley published The Doors of Perception?
Yeah, exactly. He did mescaline and had this very powerful spiritual experience in which he said that he understood what all those Eastern texts meant. Finally, he had this sort of very visceral awakening, and he wrote about it in The Doors of Perception. He went on to publish in 1958 in the Saturday Evening Post a piece advocating psychedelics, what he would call mind-manifesting drugs, specifically because of their spiritual potential. And more than that, because they were a very democratic way of having mystical experiences and experiencing divinity. And he felt in 1958 that psychedelic drugs, or these mind-manifesting drugs, would bring about a religious revival, and he even went so far to call it a religious revolution.
You said he used psychedelics to explain his spiritual experiences. He had been a serious student. I mean, he was set up to take drugs in a way that perhaps many other people weren't.
Yes, he had been a student of Indian thought, Eastern wisdom, for many years. He was a pacifist during World War II, and Vedanta had been a major theme in helping him explain and rationalize his beliefs, Vedanta being Indian philosophy that posits monism, which is the oneness of the universe, and, you know, makes the search for unity with God or divinity its main purpose. And he was, you know, philosophically a perennialist. He felt that all religions had that message, but he really leaned towards Vedanta and Zen and those sorts of philosophies that really talked about divinizing your reality and that this was possible in this life. It wasn't just for the afterlife.
One of the interesting things about looking at Huxley's experience is that he did have that spiritual background before that, and that wasn't true of all who took drugs, certainly in the 60s. And it raises the question, doesn't it? Is it important for people to have some spiritual training before they take psychedelics, or is it enough to just have a mind-blowing experience without any preparation?
That was actually the big shift in the 60s, which was that the first generation, which included Huxley and people like Christopher Isherwood and people in that circle in Los Angeles in the 50s and early 60s, they had, as you said, came with this sort of spiritual training of a sort, or at least a pretty deep knowledge. That's how they got to psychedelics. In the 60s, with all the young people dropping acid and doing mushrooms, they actually did the reverse. They took the acid, had these mind-blowing experiences, and then worked their way over to yoga often, or other types of Eastern mysticism, but very often yoga. And so the drugs led them to other forms of spiritual experience.
Were they searching for an explanation of the experience they had?
I think it went a couple of different ways. One, they certainly were searching to make sense of their trips. There was a guy named Arthur Kleps who did a tremendous amount of acid, actually accidentally, up in Millbrook in the 60s, and went out of his mind, went a little bit crazy. And later he read a very famous book on Tantra by Arthur Avalon, which is a pseudonym for Sir John Woodruff and his collaborator. And he literally said, this is what happened to me. The experience of Kundalini rising described in this tantric book is exactly what happened to me on acid. So it made sense of his trip. Other people essentially burnt out on psychedelics. And yoga was very available by the late 60s. And so people like Srila Prabhupada, who headed up the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, most people know him as the head of the Hare Krishnas, he and also Maharshi Mahesh, who's the kind of originator of TM, Transcendental Meditation, they ended up essentially converting young people from psychedelics to their forms of yoga, although, you know, Mahesh described TM as not yoga, but essentially it was yoga. It was technologies that use just your body to expand your awareness and focus your mind.
Of course, in the 60s, there was a whole period when psychedelics were essentially all there was. Timothy Leary was maybe the most famous advocate of LSD. And these days, people looking back at that say he's really a cautionary tale, that he oversold it. In some ways, I guess you look at him and you think that maybe he made it almost impossible for scientific study of psychedelics to take place later.
People certainly like to blame him as the reason why scientific research was stalled for so long. And it is understandable. I mean, you have to remember there was a lot of moral panic beyond Leary around psychedelics in the late 60s because it was such a young culture. There were 24 million young Americans by the end of the decade, which was, you know, a huge percentage of the population. And a lot of them, although I think it was probably exaggerated by the media somewhat, but a lot of them, along with a lot of adults, including corporate barons and housewives, were dropping acid and experimenting with magic mushrooms and the like. So it was a great opportunity for people to raise the alarms and insist that this was damaging our youth. And it's a great media story. It's got all the lurid sex, drugs, you know, and rock and roll elements of it. So I do think Leary went too far, and in terms of his own scientific investigation, that's pretty clear. But I would caution people, you know, in terms of blaming him. I think the scientific establishment's pretty conservative, and it was an easy way out.
Yeah. Well, there's the other side of it, too. His colleague, Richard Alpert, you've mentioned, who later changed his name to Ram Dass. He ended up renouncing the use of psychedelics.
Yeah, he basically went to India in 68 with a whole travel kit full of psychedelics, kind of searching for an answer to what they really were. And he had an experience that basically convinced him they weren't necessary anymore. He never fully renounced them as useless. For a period, he basically stopped doing them and was really focused on yoga. But I think he always saw them in moderation as potentially transformative and useful. But he started emphasizing yoga and other non-drug forms of consciousness alteration much more after his trip to India in 68.
Well, that comes back to the whole idea that with personal effort, with study, you can find spirituality and not have to use drugs in order to get it instead of doing study, I guess.
Yes, and this was always the tension with psychedelics, and something that Huxley had been arguing with various spiritual teachers in Los Angeles in the early 50s, which was this sort of notion that spiritual realization requires a lot of effort and hard work, or whether it can happen spontaneously. And most of the spiritual texts, most of the texts around yoga insist that it does require some significant effort. And what's interesting is in the late 60s, when a lot of kids were getting burnt out on drugs, the forms of yoga they were attracted to were the Hare Krishnas or Bhakti Yoga, which is the chanting, and also TM, which is the non-yoga yoga, which is really meditation with a mantra. And those forms are actually easier to learn and can transform your consciousness quite quickly if you're dedicated. And that sort of makes sense because those kids were really used to this kind of quick, almost instant consciousness alteration in, you know, being essentially jacked into these wonderful, blissful states.
Well, and everybody wants the solution now. And it's always easier to look for it in the quickest way than the hardest way.
Right. And as anyone who's practiced yoga knows, it's not a path that's easy or without its obstacles. And I definitely think if you really want to change your consciousness and have those deeper experiences, it can require some serious time and effort and having a good teacher. So it's understandable that the preference for psychedelics and the preference for techniques that seem to do that more quickly. But again, that was sort of what Huxley wrestled with way back in the early 50s. And what Leary and Alpert were kind of experimenting with both at Harvard and then later at Millbrook.
Stephanie Simon was a founder of the web magazine Feed. Her book is The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America.
Enormous crowds come out to hear me lecture. whenever I go to a college, it's always sold out. It's not because I'm that clever. It's because they gave me the good lines in the show. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
A bit later, we'll tell you how one doctor is using psychedelics to ease the fears of dying cancer patients. Up next, Dennis McKenna takes us inside a shamanic ceremony using ayahuasca. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If Timothy Leary had a successor, it may have been Terence McKenna, a philosopher, ethnobotanist, and famed psychedelic explorer. In 1971, he and his younger brother Dennis went to the Amazon in search of drug-induced visionary experiences. Well, it turned out to be a wild adventure, which launched the McKenna brothers on a lifelong quest to understand hallucinogens. Terence died a decade ago, but his brother Dennis still has a keen interest in psychedelics. Today he's a botanist and lecturer at the University of Minnesota's Center for Spirituality and Healing. Steve Paulson talked with Dennis McKenna about how shamanic cultures use hallucinogens.
Why are you so interested in psychedelics?
Well, that's a complex question. To be honest with you, I think probably a lot of my curiosity about psychedelics comes from my early interest in science fiction, which continues. And I love science fiction because science fiction pushes the edge of our understanding. I'm interested in things that are astonishing and a little bit out of our normal ken. And I guess that is what's motivated me, because psychedelics early on when I was growing up, I'm a child of the 60s, and if you were in the counterculture, you tended to be interested in psychedelics. And they appealed to me because they did just seem among the more astonishing things I'd ever encountered, particularly one of them, DMT. DMT is short for dimethyltryptamine, and I was most impressed by the profoundly altered state that it produces, but also it's very short, that it only lasts about 10 minutes, and it seems to put you into really what appears to be a parallel universe or another dimension. And then as I learned about it, I became aware that DMT is widespread in plants, and many of those plants are used around the world in shamanic practices and shamanic traditions.
And that's an important point to make, that it's not as if you're just going off and someone is taking this mind-blowing drug and then you do what you want with it. I mean, it's in a particular setting, in a ritualistic setting, and there's a whole process of how to incorporate this into your life.
Right. In order to integrate these experiences and use them in a way that you can learn from, that enhances your life or perhaps produces insight, you have to create a context. And the ritual context, the use of music, the use of visual imagery, the sometimes dancing or drumming or other practices are a way to create an appropriate setting. And the set, then, is what you bring to that in terms of your entire life experiences and your expectations, and importantly, what your intent is in taking this thing. Why are you having this experience? And shamanism is just one way to create an appropriate setting. I think in the 60s, people got into trouble because there was no context. Mm-hmm. There was no tradition.
Well, to follow up on shamanism, there's often a set of beliefs that go along with the use of psychedelics. I mean, a belief in the spirit world, that animals might have a spirit presence as well. I mean, there's a whole kind of cosmology that goes with
this. Oh, there's a cosmology, absolutely. The belief in spirit helpers, in shamanism, the notion that that illness or misfortune, and these things are often not distinguished. Illness is almost always understood to be due to malevolent spiritual influences, or someone has put a spell on you, or somehow your soul has gotten lost and the shaman has to go out and locate that soul and restore it to the body. And shamanism is very much about healing. It's almost always has a therapeutic rationale. You can say that shamanism is a belief system, but it's not quite a belief system in the way that, say, a religion is a belief system. A religion has certain tenets that if you're going to be a participant in the religion, you're more or less expected to believe. And if you want to be a good Christian, a good Catholic or whatever, you pretty much have to buy into it. Mm-hmm. I think personally that shamanism is not so much about belief as a set of, it's kind of a roadmap for navigating these other dimensions, if you want to call those, or these altered states. You don't have to believe. Shamanism is a set of practical techniques that's based on experience. Hmm. And when you take these substances, yes, I don't have to believe in a world, a spirit world. It's right there. You can experience it.
Can you tell me about one of your experiences when you went down to the Amazon and you know, you're in this ritualistic setting, taking one of these maybe psilocybin within a shamanistic context? What happened?
Well, there have been a few. I can tell you one of my important ayahuasca experiences. I've studied ayahuasca as a chemist and botanist and pharmacologist for many years. And ayahuasca, as you know, is a plant decoction made from two plants, one of which contains DMT, which would normally be orally inactive, but the other component, the other plant that is used to prepare this brew, contains another group of alkaloids called beta-carbolines that are strong inhibitors of monoamine oxidase. Beta-carbolines protect the DMT from being degraded, so it can cross the blood-brain barrier and elicit a prolonged, more prolonged experience, something like 4 hours as opposed to 10 minutes. So that's the basis of the pharmacology of ayahuasca. When I was, it's kind of a long story, but when I was studying ayahuasca back in the 90s, I was invited to a conference. Well, ayahuasca is used by indigenous people throughout the Amazon basin, but it's been adopted into syncretic religious practices, one of whom is called the UDV, the União do Vegetal is what it means, and they call it vegetal instead of ayahuasca. So this group invited myself and some colleagues to a conference that they had organized on the potential health benefits of vegetal or ayahuasca. And after the conference, they invite us all to one of their ceremonies a few miles outside Sao Paulo, and there were about 500 people participating in this. And the ayahuasca that we received was quite strong, and I was in a deep visionary state, and I'm a botanist and a plant biochemist, and so I found myself experiencing photosynthesis from the inside. Photosynthesis, of course, is what drives the whole biosphere. It's the way that carbon is sequestered out of the atmosphere, and everything in life depends on photosynthesis. And I knew the basic biochemical steps in photosynthesis, and suddenly I found myself in this visionary experience, and deep in the earth, in the root of an enormous ayahuasca plant, which is a vine, and presented itself to me as the world tree, this united heaven and earth. And this is a very common theme in shamanic journeying is to go from the underworld to the upper world via vine or a tree or a ladder or something. Well, I was on that journey. I was down in the middle of the plumbing, literally, and I could hear the water dripping and the whole circulatory system of this root system in the middle of the Amazon. And suddenly I realized I was seeing this from the standpoint of a water molecule. And I was being transported from the roots into the leaves of the Banisteriopsis plant where the photosynthetic process goes on. Well, suddenly I'm on this like conveyor belt and I can see, you know, the antenna of the chlorophyll in the membrane of the chloroplasts. They're like little antenna-shaped structures at the, embedded in this dome-shaped structure, which stretched above me like the size of a cathedral, and I could see it collecting the sunlight and the sunlight being translocated through the membrane like lightning bolts, and I'm being moved along this conveyor belt toward this anvil on which these poor water molecules are being split asunder. and you know, and I'm about to be totally annihilated. So that was what I was experiencing.
Now, when you say you were seeing this, were your eyes closed?
My eyes were closed.
Okay, so this
was like
all
a dream, okay. But it was more than that. It wasn't that I was simply visualizing it. I was being shown it. There was a voice that was narrating what was happening, and I knew enough plant biochemistry to kind of know what the stages of photosynthesis were, but there was a voice. It was a very emotional experience because it was all about, you know, this is the force that sustains life on the planet. This is the Amazon, and you guys, you monkeys, are wrecking this situation. You're destroying the planet, yet at the same time, the voice was very sort of reassuring and said, this is what's sustaining life. You don't understand. You monkeys only think you're running things. You're not running things. About that time, the vision faded and tears were streaming down my face, and it was a very emotional thing.
What I find so interesting about this ayahuasca experience you've just described is clearly, you brought a lot of your own knowledge into that. I mean, the fact that you are a botanist, that you know a lot about sort of the chemistry of plants, I mean, that was somehow incorporated into your vision. And presumably,
and other people would have different
a totally different experience.
Yes,
and I mean, it just sort of it raises fascinating questions about why you have the experience that you have.
You bring to the experience what you know. You know, I mean, a computer scientist would bring a different set of skills and knowledge to it. It might be communicating with some kind of super computer of some kind, or a molecular biologist might have a completely different experience. In fact, Jeremy Narby, who wrote a book about ayahuasca called The Cosmic Serpent, claims that the shamans and the molecular biologists are not that far apart, that the cosmic serpent that they often see in the ayahuasca state is really DNA, or DNA is really the cosmic serpent. You can't say one is real and the other isn't, but that there is an intuitive understanding of this kind of fundamental life process that ayahuasca gives you. And I don't, frankly, think that's so far out. I mean, Carrie Mullis, the Nobel Prize-winning molecular biologist, is quite out front about the fact that his insights into how DNA work came from his LSD experiences, and he's quite unapologetic about that. Why is that so crazy? We are biochemical systems. The biosphere, in some sense, is like a huge organism. It's like a cell. We're mere organelle in this huge cellular system, and then there are layers and layers of organization. So when you experience that, you know, you kind of recognize, or it's shoved into your face, that we are biochemical systems.
Dennis McKenna, talking with Steve Paulson. McKenna is a lecturer at the University of Minnesota's Center for Spirituality and Healing and a co-founder of the Hefter Research Institute. So what do you think about psychedelics? You can send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, how one doctor is using hallucinogens for people with late-stage cancer. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
People in this country don't talk about death. It's scary, especially being in a situation where I just found out I'm dying. You know, it's scary to know that I'm going to be looking that right in the face.
That's Annie Levy, a woman who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She went on to take part in an experimental study in which late-stage cancer patients took psilocybin to see if it would ease their fear and panic about dying. For Annie, the results were dramatic. A single dose of psilocybin changed her life during her final months. Levy was part of a groundbreaking study by Charles Grobe, a psychiatrist at the UCLA Medical School. And Strainchamp sat down with Grobe to talk about his research on psychedelics.
What made you consider giving psilocybin to cancer patients in the first place?
I was very impressed with the literature from the 1960s and early 1970s, where investigators were working with a hallucinogen treatment model with people with terminal cancer and finding, you know, quite remarkable responses in regards to their psychological condition. And we felt this would be a very important area to revisit. You know, unfortunately, because of the cultural upheaval that occurred in the 60s, all of this research was shut down by the late 60s, early 70s. And it took, you know, some decades for it to be even possible. And I think we have to catch up.
Tell me about the study itself. Who were the people you set out to study?
Well, we had approval to treat 12 adult patients with advanced cancer who had anxiety. So we were treating the anxiety, not the cancer. As it turns out, of the 12 subjects we treated, 11 were women. I think that just turned out to be a chance event. So we worked with 11 women and one man, all with metastatic cancer, all with very limited life expectancies, and all with significant anxiety. Many had depression. Many had experienced a significant deterioration in their quality of life, and they were looking for something that might help them, that might help ease the tremendous anxiety they had about their life circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And how did you go about administering the drug? Did they get some preparation? How did you introduce it to them?
Everyone was screened, which was a rather involved process. And then we had a period of preparatory psychotherapy where we got to know the subjects, they got to know us, we explained the purpose of the study, the likely effects that might occur, and we also, very importantly, established rapport. It's very important for the subjects in a study like this to feel comfortable with the facilitators of the treatment. So they met with myself and my research coordinator. Really, we helped them get ready for the experience. The study itself, we had a double-blind placebo-controlled study. Each subject came in for two experimental treatment sessions, spaced several weeks apart. On one occasion, they received the psilocybin. On the other occasion, they received a placebo. All subjects got one of each, although the order was randomized, and we never knew what order they would receive that.
So you didn't even know when you were interacting with them whether they'd taken the drug or not?
No, we had not been informed. Only the research pharmacists know. However, in many cases, it was quite apparent who was in an altered state and who was not.
Well, what did you expect would happen?
The hope certainly was that the treatment might facilitate some lessening of their anxiety, particularly the existential anxiety focused on their short life expectancy. And I think to a significant degree, our expectations were realized. People did report less anxiety, improved mood, improved overall quality of life. We found that individuals were able, and this was interesting, to become more functional. You know, they previously had felt themselves unable to socialize. There was often a lot of tension and anxiety in the home. Communication problems often existed with their partners and important family and friends. And subsequent, they reported back to us, you know, a fairly substantial improvement in their day-to-day interactions, often there was a lot of healing that appeared to occur during the treatment process in regards to relationship. Mm-hmm. We felt it really helped heal relationship wounds.
How did they describe the actual psychedelic experience mm-hmm. itself?
Right.
And what happened?
I'll say first, we were approved to work with a moderate dose, but that being the case, our subjects often reported very beautiful aesthetic experience, visions of pastoral scenes of nature, patterns of color, which they reported to be quite beautiful and infused with almost an implicit kind of a spiritual sense. They also reported important autobiographic insight. They often did life reviews. They would sometimes examine old conflicts and old injuries. The model was, after we administered the medicine, we had our subjects lie down, put on eye shades, put on headphones connected to pre-selected music. We advised them to go as deeply as possible. We checked in every hour for a blood pressure measurement and to see how they're doing. Most of the talking we reserved for later. We had one woman who was crying a great deal at about the four-hour point. You know, I thought it might have something to do with her limited life expectancy, but, you know, I waited for the next hour point, and I didn't want to interrupt, but I then asked her what had been going through her mind, and she said, in fact, that she had been revisiting her relationship with her father, who had passed on many years before. And the tears were because she said she had never been able to tell him how much she loved him while he was still alive. So very, very poignant. And there, I think there were a lot of healing occurred. Now, with some of our subjects, not all, and again, this was a moderate dose study here, they also reported, you know, tapping into almost kind of a psycho-spiritual level, often consistent with their pre-existing belief system.
When you say a psycho-spiritual or a mystical experience, and that it was partly conditioned by their previous religious beliefs,
right.
Do you mean that, I mean, did some feel they saw Jesus, or they saw angels, or they had a vision of an afterlife?
Oh, absolutely. If they came from a Christian background, there was often, you know, symbols associated with that. For one subject, the music that was playing was the Ave Maria, and she was deeply, deeply moved and felt herself in a very exalted state. For another subject who was a Buddhist practitioner, she had a sense of being held by Buddhist monks and being nurtured and comforted, and she reported that she felt her anxiety just draining out of her, leaving her far more at ease and at peace with her situation.
Did many of them come away feeling that they had had a kind of glimpse of death as not the end?
Another notable outcome appeared to be lessened fear of death.
But is that because they thought death wasn't the end, or simply because they thought, well, I've seen that my whole life makes sense, I can
right.
put
well,
it to rest now?
I think there was both. There was a life review and there was a lot of healing going on, but also a sense that life does not necessarily, or let's say that the soul does not necessarily extinguish at the end point of life. A sense of perhaps there may be some level of existence even beyond.
I know as a scientist, I know in advance you're not going to want to answer this question, but did you come away yourself feeling that this was purely an interior experience, a kind of, you know, dream that these patients had had, or do you think that they, did it make you feel that there might be something after death?
Well, I was deeply moved working with these people, and they were tremendous respect. It was really a privilege to work with them and really observe their courage. The whole process forced me to examine my own mortality, and I think I came away also with some, you know, kind of sense that there might be something beyond.
It seems so interesting to me that you're dealing with two subjects that our culture has made taboo. In some ways, you know, we tend to push away thoughts of death and not want to deal very closely with it, and we don't want to deal with the dying either, mm-hmm. and that often happens out of sight now in our culture. And we're also very, very leery of hallucinogens. Are those things related at all?
It's a good question. I hadn't quite looked at it like that, but we are culturally conditioned to be aversive to even acknowledging the finality of our own existence. And, of course, with the hallucinogen, that's a whole other issue. They were very, very much out in front during the 60s, initially as research compounds, but then escaping the labs, escaping the research settings, diffusing into the greater culture, causing tremendous levels of upheaval. Young people poorly prepared, perhaps quite vulnerable, taking the drugs under unwise conditions, would sometimes get into problems. There was a perception of serious public health issues. As a result, the regulatory agencies had to shut down all work with this. So there's certainly that. I think we needed to wait several decades for the rancor of the 60s to be put to rest. And we needed the protagonists to exit the stage. Mm. And, you know, to paraphrase the Moody Blues, Timothy Leary really is dead, and we don't have to resurrect his ghost as a lightning rod for controversy. Let's put that aside. Let's leave that in the past. Let's move on and objectively examine the true potentialities of these compounds when administered under optimal conditions, and I stress optimal conditions.
That's Charles Grobe, a psychiatrist at the UCLA Medical School, talking with N. Strange Champs. One of Dr. Grobe's research subjects, Annie Levy, was interviewed for a documentary film by Rosalind Dauber about the medical use of psychedelics. Here are a few of Annie's comments about her experience with psilocybin.
As soon as it started working, I knew I had nothing to be afraid of because it connected me with the universe. And it was very gentle. There were people right there if I got upset, although crying is okay. I mean, people cry in therapy all the time, and it's not a disastrous thing. But I certainly felt that if anything scary happened, I wasn't alone. I would recommend psilocybin treatment for anyone with a terminal or potentially terminal illness. I mean, I think it's an incredibly useful tool. What we did, it probably would have taken me years of therapy, or at least a year. And it's so vivid and so real, and you're right. You can go right into your emotions. You can just cut right through all the nonsense that you fool yourself with and just look at reality. But also my relationship with my mother improved because I told her, it took me like almost a year and a half, I told her about that I was in the study just a few months ago. I finally told her because she was very anti-drug. And I played a radio show that I was on for her, and we have gotten so much closer since I opened up that part of my life to her. It broke through a barrier.
The comments of Annie Levy, who has since died from cancer. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've just heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Psychedelics Show, number 66A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from N. Strange Champs, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.